This is Sparks from Radio Fax on 6205 and 12255. Fresh programmes start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you would like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
Hi there! I'm on my way, I'm making it. I've got to make it show, yeah. So much larger than life. We'll be right back.
From The New Scientist, The Medium Hides the Message, Doc Stewart on the Surge in Subliminal Tapes. Here's a clever new product for the insatiable American Don Juan, the personalised subliminal audio tape from a company called Mephisto. Yours for the low, low mail order price of $89.95. This ultimate aphrodisiac, as the order form refers to it, is 60 minutes of beautiful music with subaudible messages hidden behind all the violins. The messages urge any females within earshot who are 18 and over to abandon themselves to wild passion. A subaudible warning waves off minors. To keep your quarry from becoming fixated on the wrong male, your name is worked into the tape 122 times. Mephisto is just one of a crowd of companies selling subliminal tapes to buyers eager for high-tech self-help, though most of the marketing claims are more subdued. Consumers in the US now spend roughly $1 million a week on tapes to increase self-esteem, reduce stress, clear up acne, learn a foreign language, develop ESP, and send cancer into remission. The best sellers are stop smoking and weight loss tapes. On most subliminal tapes, side one is a straightforward, clearly enunciated pep talk, "I am successful," "All actions lead to my success," and so on, backed by ocean waves and intervals of throbbing synthesizer muzak. Side two typically seems to be all music. According to their producers, however, low decibel versions of the messages on side one have been tucked beneath the soundtrack. On a few tapes, a listener wearing earphones who turns up the volume during brief lulls in the music can hear brief snatches of speech. On most tapes, however, no voices are noticeable. Here's the theory. Subliminal messages, which by definition we're unaware of, slip past our conscious mind and speak directly to our subconscious. Yet despite the millions of tapes sold to date, hard evidence that subliminal message therapy is more than wishful thinking simply doesn't exist. The tape industry points to a rash of new experimental evidence that people can perceive a stimulus without being aware of it. That, for instance, test subjects shown a split-second image of either a circle or a triangle without knowing it are apt to pick out the shape they glimpsed when subsequently offered a choice. But a momentary test preference or a brief EEG spike, a chorus of researchers points out, does not a therapy make. The tape makers, they say, appear to be cheerfully sowing confusion in the public's mind between unconscious perception and Freud's notion of the subconscious, as though there were a neurological pipeline from one to the other. Timothy Moore, a psychologist at Toronto's York University, once switched the labels on "improve your memory" and "boost your self-esteem" tapes, then had volunteers listen to one or the other for a month. The tapes had no measurable impact. However, he wrote, those who thought they had a memory tape reported that they believed their memories had improved. According to the packaging accompanying one tape, the speaker's voice has undergone spectral analysis, then been separated into subharmonic chord components. Thus altered, the voice becomes an integral part of the music itself. The process seems akin to altering a page of text by cutting all the letters out and hiding them behind letters on another page. What's the eardrum supposed to make of the result? Philip Miracle, a psychologist at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, carried out an acoustical analysis of tapes from three companies and found no evidence of subaudible voices on any of the recordings. No speech, Miracle reported, means no stimulus and thus no subliminal effect, unless, of course, they work by ESP. asks for experimental proof that subliminal messages can have a therapeutic effect, the subliminal tape defenders offer anecdotes and testimonials. A migraine cure here, an A on a test there. Yet the absence of any scientific underpinnings doesn't prove that subliminal tapes are utterly worthless. It's common sense that people who make a commitment to listening to a diet tape every day for 6 weeks, the usual duration suggested, are at least bringing their eating problems to the regular attention of their conscious minds, if not their subconscious. Subliminal tape advocates point out that the technology in its infancy is in its infancy and that scientific studies will follow once there's enough money to fund them. A cynic might counter that there is too much money being made and that a definitive large-scale study would only threaten the cash flow. Anyone with such a jaundiced view of his fellow human beings, however, would do well to spend the next 6 weeks listening daily to How to Be Positive, or perhaps Anger Control. The tapes may not help, but it's the thought that counts.
That was Doug Stewart writing in The New Scientist. This is Dee Light, What is Love?
We've been trying to find out, is there really such a thing?
Right.
This is Sparks, Radio Fax's weekly programme of technical news and features. From Electronics World News, car radios tune in to the FM system by Janis Motafis in Berlin. A frequency modulation FM demodulating system that promises to do for car radios what the Dolby system did for hi-fi equipment in the 1970s will take to the road this autumn. Developed by HUC Electronic GmbH, the DynAS system will make its debut in September at the Berlin Consumer Electronics Show in the stereo car radios of major Japanese and European manufacturers. DynAS dramatically increases the sensitivity and selectivity of receivers, essentially nullifying the interference that plagues reception in large metropolitan areas. In these locations, the FM band is crammed with stations, strong and weak, usually separated from one another by no more than 0.1 or 0.2 of a megahertz. Most of DynAS can be integrated on a single semiconductor chip, and thus should add about $7 or $8 on average to the cost of a receiver in the future. In the early stages, however, the additional cost would be up to $30. At the outset, DynAS will find its way only into top-of-the-line radios, but the system should reach mid-range sets within 1 or 2 years. The DynAS system thwarts interference by constantly analysing the instantaneous reception conditions and adjusting the demodulator filter network accordingly. This boosts selectivity to the point where an adjacent channel 0.2 of a megahertz away from the desired channel must have to have 35 dB higher field strength before interference becomes noticeable. With only 0.1 of a megahertz separation, the level drops to 20 dB. In terms of sensitivity, the signal-to-noise ratio of a conventional receiver, typically 26 dB, is shifted with the help of DynAS by about 8 dB towards the smaller field intensity, thus making it possible to receive remote stations whose strength is below the noise level. To dynamically match the resonant range and characteristics of the filters, the system monitors the instantaneous IF, the level of the signal of the tuned station, and its relationship to the adjacent channel signals. The control voltage for the filters is derived from the audio frequency, whose level depends on the instantaneous IF level. Because the filters continuously track the IF, they can have extremely narrow bandwidth. Under certain reception conditions, DynAS cuts the bandwidth to 18 MHz, 10% of the band of a conventional filter. The initial advantage of this sort of filter bandwidth reduction is that the noise bandwidth is correspondingly reduced, which in turn enhances reception sensitivity and selectivity. The field strength of the tuned and adjacent channel signals also comes into play. The lower field intensity of the signal, the greater the reception sensitivity. The greater the field strength ratio of the interference to the desired station, the greater the selectivity. However, greater selectivity and sensitivity don't necessarily imply the same filter characteristics. DynAS switches in 3 levels of filtering, depending on the field intensity, and 5, depending on the field strength ratio of interference to the desired station. Among other features that enhance performance and reduce system components are the muting detection, which reacts to both background noise and reflection distortion.
Don't let
This is Sparks from Radio Facts. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us all about yourself, where you live and what you do. I promise to give you a mention on this programme. Our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you would like a reply, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
MC Hazard's in a tunnel of trouble. Under the channel is an electromagnetic hell by Lucia Costanzo in Electronic Times. Electromagnetic compatibility is on everyone's minds this year as industry prepares for the European directive. It is also a concern for the builders of the Channel Tunnel, which when completed will yield an environment of electromagnetic hell. Huge overhead cables carrying currents of 32,000 volts, high-speed trains travelling at more than 100 miles an hour, and even a rabies trap will all radiate interference. Susceptibility is an important issue because the critical train signalling and other control systems must operate whatever happens. The Channel Tunnel is a fascinating project involving many technologies, from tunnelling to electrical engineering, said Martin Green, Managing Director of Interference Technology International Consultants, I2C. The electronics side is equally broad, involving everything from servo systems to microprocessors, he said. Last year, Green's Swindon-based company won a contract to provide EMC consultancy to Transmanche Link, builders of the tunnel. I2C is looking at all possible causes of interference and making recommendations to ensure that equipment supplied meets susceptibility requirements far in excess of the European directive. The main cause for concern to the I2C team, led by former Ford Cars EMC expert Keith Blackmore, is the large electrical currents needed to power the trains passing through the tunnel and to maintain essential services. The overhead catenary must be one of the world's biggest aerials, said Green. Electricity is supplied from two power stations situated near Folkestone on the English side and near Calais on the other side of the channel. Power is fed through the tunnel from either end, with a neutral section in the middle as each country produces power at different voltages. Two types of train will pass through the tunnel. Trains 700 metres long and carrying cars and lorries will travel through at speeds of up to 150 miles an hour. The smaller shuttle trains will carry passengers. At some stage, the 700 metre trains will have to draw current from the French and UK side, making power breaks at very high voltages necessary. As there may be several trains in the tunnel at any moment, very high switching currents will be produced, with the consequent risk of sparking if EMC design is not carefully thought out. Radiated interference will be an important issue in the tunnel as well. I2C has concluded that there are more than 1,000 transmitters, and the list is still not finished. A wide array of communications equipment will be used, ranging from a radio network for security guards to a local radio station, either piped into cars or transmitted on VHF. This means that we must meet European norms on emissions to maintain the quality of transmission, said Green. We have looked at every radiated source and what they could accidentally emit, from communications facilities to program controllers for the firefighting and drainage system. All these have been addressed. In its far-reaching examination of possible interference hazards, I2C has also examined future emitters and even illegal and secret military transmissions. GSM, operating at 1.8 GHz, will also have to be taken into account, as this pan-European digital telephone standard should become widespread by the end of the decade. Most immunity specifications stop at 1 GHz, so if we kept to the regulations, we wouldn't incorporate GSM. Shipborne radar from military exercises in the area must also be taken into account, as must illegal in-car radios. There are CB radio users around that pump 500 watts out of an aerial. This is illegal, but we must be aware of it. Electromagnetic susceptibility is as vital an issue as emission. For example, there are equipment rooms situated every 375 metres in the tunnels. These rooms, bulging with sensitive electronic control equipment, are just metres away from the overhead catenary. This equipment must work in conditions far worse than the standard commercial or industrial environment. The rabies trap, included in the tunnel as a way of stopping adventurous French foxes from walking through the tunnel, also involves EMC considerations. The trap design is an electrified grid with a 6.8 kilovolt pulse passed through. The net result looks remarkably like a charging and discharging capacitor. The rabies trap is situated near the train location system, which informs drivers of the trains where they are in the pitch-black tunnel. The I2C consultants have had to ensure that interference from the trap does not adversely affect this system. Without it, the driver is totally lost. It would be like driving down the motorway at night at 120 miles an hour with no lights on. Green's consultants have also looked at potential fault conditions to specify EMC protection even if the worst happens. We calculated what would happen if the catenary fell on the train track. It could be almost explosive, he said. That piece about electromagnetic compatibility in the Channel Tunnel from Electronic Times.
Rock my boat.
Don't rock my boat.
Cause I don't want my boat to be rocking.
Don't rock my boat.
Oh, please, don't you rock my boat.
Don't
no,
rock
no.
My boat.
Cause I don't want my boat to be rocking.
Don't rock my
I'm
boat.
I'm telling you that, oh.
Winner.
Watch out.
around the corner. Oh, I said, baby, never let me be alone.
Hi-tech loses decoder appeal, from Electronics Times. The legal battle between BBC Enterprises and Hi-tech Extravision has been settled, with Hi-tech losing its appeal in the House of Lords. Hi-tech had built decoders, allowing European viewers to watch BBC satellite television, but was sued by the corporation for selling them without its permission. The BBC claimed infringement under the 1988 Copyright Act. Hi-tech disputed this on the grounds that the decoders were sold outside the UK, but agreed to reimburse £100 for each of the 400 decoders it had sold. It has so far repaid the cost of about 320, according to the BBC. The corporation lost the original hearing, but the ruling was overturned on appeal. Hi-tech then appealed to the House of Lords. BBC Enterprises wants to regain the profits Hi-tech made from the sale of the decoders and will seek costs. It is believed to be the first time this part of copyright law has been tested in court. Chris Carey, Hi-tech's managing director, had said he would move manufacturing out of the UK if he lost the Lords' appeal. He was not available for comment. Chris Carey is also the managing director of Radio Nova, first in Ireland and then on the Astra satellite. Our friends at Radio Caroline, of course, recently borrowed this satellite channel from him. There will be a full report on the decoder case in another Sparks programme.
Oh,
Sparks from Radiofax, 6205 and 12255. NASA pays high price to save space station from New Scientist. Freedom, the International Space Station, has survived the most determined effort yet to kill it. Last week, the US House of Representatives voted to restore $1.8 billion that House committees had slashed weeks earlier from the station's budget for 1992. Although the vote restored the space station, it froze funding at 1991 levels for every other program within NASA. Richard Truly, NASA's administrator, accepted this as the price of preserving the space station, because it is an important national priority, he said. Now NASA and Congress must work out new priorities for the rest of the agency's programs. The vote came after weeks of fierce congressional infighting and intensive lobbying on behalf of the space station by the State Department and the White House, and by Europe and Japan, international partners in the venture. Jean-Marie Luton, who is Director General of the European Space Agency, has told yet another House committee that Europe has already spent about $1 billion designing its contributions to the space station. He said that if the US cancelled Freedom, Europe would continue alone with the manned exploration of space. The Japanese government said that if the space station was cancelled, it would not participate in other big science programs, such as the superconducting Super Collider. The space station has caused controversy from the start. It has encountered numerous funding problems, and critics have complained that the program is unfocused. In particular, the Space Studies Board, a committee of the National Research Council, said earlier this year that the space station cannot be justified on scientific grounds. Last week's vote followed 6 hours of debate. Proponents portrayed the station as US's stepping stone to the universe. Opponents argued that funding Freedom at the expense of other programs within NASA would cause the agency to eat its young. Eventually, to the surprise of pundits, the House supported the station with a majority of 67. The row over the funding of the space station was sparked off when the House Appropriation Committees responsible for the station's budget unexpectedly cut the program's allocation from the $2 billion requested to $100 million. They took everyone by surprise, says Ian Pryke, the ESA representative in Washington. Once the Appropriations Committees had made the cut, many of the scientists, who had been stern critics of the space station's cost and aims, emerged to lobby members of the House to maintain the cut in a full vote on the floor. The American Geophysical Union, officially opposed to the space station, set up a desk at its spring meeting in Baltimore last month and urged delegates to call Congress with their views. Scientific opposition to the cost of manned exploration has been around since the Apollo program. This year, that opposition was strengthened by the US's wider budget problems. The country sets aside about 50% of every tax dollar to pay interest on its national debt, and this year Congress must abide by the strict constraints it hammered out so painfully with the White House last year. Freedom, which NASA says will cost $30 billion, and the US government's accounting office says it will cost $40 billion, is seen by many in Congress as a budgetary black hole. According to NASA's figures, the program will need $2 billion or more a year for the rest of the decade. Once the space station is launched, it will cost many billions more to operate. Exactly how much more is a matter of fierce debate, both among politicians and scientists. While official support from the full House is generally perceived as important for the survival of the space station, the program is still not out of the woods. The Senate has yet to go through the process of authorizing and appropriating funds. Then the Senate and the House must reach agreement and eventually seek the President's approval. Richard Darman, head of the Office of Management and Budget, said last week he would advise the President to veto any bill that does not contain close to full funding for the space station. Both sides of the Congress must now re-examine the rest of NASA's budget for 1992. If the House vote stands, the agency will receive $13.8 billion overall. It requested $15.7 billion. None of the agency's programs will receive increases in funds next year. One program that could be in serious trouble is CRAF Cassini. CRAF is a spacecraft which is intended to rendezvous with an asteroid, while Cassini is a joint mission with ESA bound for Saturn. They are bracketed together because both will use the same kind of spacecraft. To continue developing the program, the agency needs about $200 million next year, more than it received this year. Of the two missions, NASA is most likely to cancel CRAF. That was from New Scientist. The original version from Eddie Floyd. This is Radio Facts, the programme Sparks, a weekly technical news and features review presented by Prof Parker, Trevor Brook, Ruth Phillips and Andy Bradgate.
Will disc break the tape in a race to find a successor to audio compact cassette? Barry Fox investigates in Electronic Times. Next year will go down in history for a bloodbath in the consumer electronics market, which could well put some companies out of the sector forever. Philips and Matsushita will fight Sony to establish a new format for home audio recording. Sony already sees Minidisc MD, its 2.5-inch recordable disc system, as a long-term replacement for the 5-inch CD. So does Philips, which is why Philips is so desperate for its digital tape system, DCC, to win over MD. Philips and Matsushita have both made plain that they see DCC as the logical successor, only to the conventional compact cassette. While this battle rages, Sony will be fighting alongside Philips and Matsushita to make 5-inch CDI, the new multimedia disc standard. The competition here is Commodore's CD-TV. But already Intel is talking seriously of offering a domestic version of its DVI variant of CD-ROM, and at least two games companies are cooking up their own rival multimedia CD systems. Already Denon has proposed a quad-density CD. A modified disc and player squeeze 80 minutes from a pressed 3-inch disc. Sony has promised Arista, a similar system for extending the playing time of recordable discs, like Minidisc. Minidisc is a magneto-optical MO recorder. Conventional MO systems, as used by the computer industry, rely on a disc coated with rare earth material. The disc spins in a constant bias of magnetic field. A laser beam, modulated with the signal to be recorded, heats spots of the coating. As the hot spots cool, they magnetize according to the surrounding bias field. The recording can read by a laser because the spots slightly change the polarization of light reflected from the surface. The snag is that a new recording can only be made after the previous recording has been erased by a constant power laser. Either two lasers must be used, which is expensive, or the same laser must be constantly switched between erase and record modes in separate passes, which increases the time taken to make a recording. Minidisc overwrites previous recordings in one pass with a single laser by modulating the magnetic field instead of the laser. This is an old idea, but not previously practicable for portable battery-powered recorders. Sony's trick is to use a coating of terbium ferrite cobalt, which needs only around one-third the magnetic energy needed to switch its state. Recordings made using MO, which cause only small changes in polarization, will not play back in conventional CD players. This is why Sony has made MD a different size, 2.5 inches, from conventional CD, 5 or 3 inches. But the MD recorder will play back a new generation of 2.5-inch pressed discs. This is possible because the readout head of the MD recorder has two sensors, which in different combinations can read either reflection pattern. So far, portable disc players have not been able to withstand shocks anywhere near as well as tape players. MD reads data off the disc at 1.4 megabits per second. But the decoder needs only 0.3 megabits per second for playback. The data from the disc is fed into a 1 megabit buffer, which gives the player 3 seconds grace to reposition the readout head after it has been knocked off track by a shock. Like DCC, MD uses data compression to reduce the number of digital bits needed. DCC reduces to a quarter, MD to a fifth. This is what lets the tiny disc store 74 minutes of stereo, the same as a full-size CD. The coding system, Adaptive Transform Acoustic Coding, ATRAC, works on a similar principle to DCC's Precision Adaptive Subband Coding, PASC. Both rely on threshold and masking effects. They code only those sounds which the ear can hear. Philips' secret worry for the last year, since Sony first talked of MD, has been that only hi-fi buffs will notice the audio compromise which follows from compression, and the public at large will switch from buying CDs to MDs. This is exactly what worried Philips 5 years ago, when Sony pushed the 3-inch CD as a new 20-minute single. Philips feared then that Sony would use CDI data compression to extend 3-inch time to over 1 hour, thereby splitting and compromising the CD standard. Sony launched the 3-inch disc only as a single, and thought again. The result is Minidisc. Sony will not introduce MD until the latter half of next year, probably autumn 1992. This puts it several months behind DCC, Digital Compact Cassette. And Sony's official line is that it is still interested in joining Philips on DCC. But MD press launches in Tokyo and New York, and demonstrations now being given to the record companies, are clearly intended to steal commitment away from DCC. As a gesture, both Philips and Sony have now said that they will support each other's system with software, via PolyGram and CBS, as soon as hardware is on the market. But nothing can conceal the full bitterness of the battle ahead. Sony is already working on further development of MD, including the adoption of Arista. This is the method, which Sony announced in February, of increasing the density of magneto-optical recordings by a factor of 6, while still using conventional infrared lasers. Denon has now announced quad-density CD, a method of increasing the recording density of conventional pressed CD by a factor of 4. Denon uses a shorter wavelength laser and modified optics. Denon's work follows similar proposals by Nimbus in September 1988. These systems, which squeeze more bits on the disc, could be used either to extend the playing time of MD with A-track, or to provide the same playing time from MD without data compression. One plan is to offer a professional version of MD with higher audio specification. By coincidence, or clever planning, Sony's announcement of MD came just as Matsushita finally announced its commitment to digital compact cassette at the annual European Technics seminar. Although Matsushita executives would say nothing about MD, pleading ignorance, what they said on DCC will be music to Philips's ears. Ted Abe, planning manager for advanced technology in Technics audio division, demonstrated DCC using an unlabeled deck, which he stressed was jointly made with Philips. 10 years ago, I bought a prototype CD player to this seminar, said Abe. CD has been an amazing success and has created an enormous business. Today, I have brought another prototype as a potential successor to the analog cassette. I am very confident DCC will create a new era as digital successor to the analog cassette.
Marianne Faithfull, Broken English. This is Sparks from Radio Facts every Monday on 6205 and 12255. Fresh programmes from Radio Facts start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you would like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, drawn by me, I'm not an artist, I should add, but it sounds good, doesn't it? Please send 50 pence, 3 and international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Here's a record from a fairly new British band called Frasier Chorus. It's called Nothing.
From Electronics Weekly, 5-year-olds think science is a boy's job. Primary school children, both boys and girls, still regard science and engineering as almost exclusively the province of men, according to a national survey published jointly by the Engineering Council and the NASUWT Teachers Union. The findings are bad news for engineering firms and institutions hoping to attract more women into engineering to make up for declining numbers of young people. The survey of 259 boys and 247 girls, all aged 5, found that the children tended to pigeonhole activities into men-only and women-only occupations. The former included science, firefighting, mountain climbing, and grass cutting, while teaching, hairdressing, shopping, and cooking were seen as jobs for women. Professor Alan Smithers and Pauline Zintek of Manchester University School of Education, who conducted the research, say in the report that today's children seem to be following the social recipes of their parents and grandparents. Children whose mothers worked in professional occupations tended to pigeonhole jobs less into male and female categories. 2/3 of teachers questioned in the survey said they thought that the national curriculum would help to break down sexual stereotypes among children by ensuring that all youngsters studied the same core subjects. But most said that these benefits would be stalled by lack of resources, large class sizes, and too little non-contact time for teachers.
That was from Electronics Weekly.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin. I'll play that for you if you're an old hippie. I'm rapidly becoming one, I think. Young hippie, I suppose. Neo-hippie or something like that. Well, this is Sparks. Now, a lot of this programme will in future be made up with your letters and replies to them, but this is the very first programme, so I shall appeal for you to write to me into the ether and we'll see what appears. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. I'll repeat the address again. Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. We also intend to run a weekly unlicensed radio feature, and we need your help. Please send in reports of pirate stations in your area you've heard recently. Shortwave, FM, or medium wave reports are all appreciated. I look forward to hearing from you. Here's the Police, Message in a Bottle.
You need before I fall into this.
Digital TV Spotlight in Electronics Weekly. Satellite broadcasters. Will Mac become the European standard for high-definition television? If it is, will Europe suffer? Kark Schneider finds out. Over the past year, a number of papers and articles have appeared arguing that analog broadcasting systems such as Mac are about to be superseded by new, fully digital broadcasting techniques, thanks to recent improvements in digital data compression technology. They say that US firms such as AT&T are pushing ahead with digital HDTV, and that by plumping prematurely for Mac, the European TV industry will be digging its own technological grave. But the arguments are not as straightforward as some make out. In particular, the timing of HDTV, and more importantly, the 16:9 widescreen format, could be more important than the technology used to deliver it. When Mac was first developed 10 years ago, digital broadcasting was just a pipe dream. Even a year ago, nobody had even a demonstration running of digital HDTV broadcasting. But enormous strides have been made recently in digital compression techniques, driven by the wide range of potential applications, ranging from HDTV to interactive multimedia and video phones. At the HDTV World Conference held in Las Vegas last month, several US firms reported successful demonstrations of digital high-definition broadcasting. The United States broadcasting regulator, the FCC, is due to set the United States HDTV broadcasting standard in 1993. Over the coming year, it will evaluate several alternative proposals for the standard. A year ago, all of the contenders for the United States broadcasting standards used either analog or hybrid analog and digital technology. Since then, four of the five contenders have switched to fully digital systems. One of these is backed by a consortium which includes Philips and Thomson Consumer Electronics, the two firms which are pushing most strongly for Mac in Europe. Mac supporters in Europe insist that fully integrated high-definition television is not on the cards before the end of the century, but some US firms are now claiming that digital HDTV will be available in the same timescale as HD Mac, i.e. between 1995 and the year 2000. Zenith, the US TV maker, which is working with AT&T on a digital HDTV system, says it expects to have hardware in the shops by 1995. However, many industry observers, including some people working on digital systems, are sceptical about these claims. "We don't have a single piece of working hardware in the US," one senior TV engineer told Electronics Weekly. "We are now confident that we can do it. But can you do it now?" Even assuming the FCC adopts a digital standard in 1993, they say it will be many years before anything like a full HDTV service is up and running. Broadcasters will not want to make the huge investment in digital HDTV broadcasting equipment until there is scope for recouping the money through advertising, and that requires a large installed base of HDTV receivers. Equally, few people will be keen to buy HDTV sets when all they can pick up is a few hours of programming each week. The US industry have bad memories of the introduction of colour in the late 1950s, which almost killed the TV industry for 10 years. Supporters of Mac says that it offers a clear path to HDTV, satellite broadcasters using DMAC in the UK and D2MAC in the rest of Europe, offer the consumer new programmes and the widescreen 16:9 CinemaScope format. This will be the hook to persuade consumers to buy the new equipment. Indeed, some people argue that the switch to 16:9 is more important in the eyes of the consumer than the jump to full high-definition television. A large installed base of Mac equipment will be, in turn, the incentive for broadcasters to invest in HD Mac equipment and begin full broadcasting between 1995 and 1997. Most DMAC and D2MAC sets will be compatible with HDMAC transmissions, although they will not have the full high-resolution picture. But timing is critical if MAC is to be introduced on the back of satellite broadcasting. There are already more than 2 million satellite receivers in Europe that can only accept the old PAL broadcasts used by Sky's Astra satellite and most other European satellite broadcasters at present. Every month sees a further 50,000 or so PAL satellite dishes go up. If MAC is to become the European standard, it must be enforced soon. Because of the chicken-and-egg problem of persuading manufacturers and broadcasters to adopt HDTV, timing could be the most important factor in determining standards, even if it means adopting less advanced technology. Any time you develop a system, you know you can have a better one tomorrow, said one senior United States TV manufacturer. But for high-definition TV, the crucial question is when, not what.
BBC has decided to close its Daventry shortwave station. This is what the engineering press statement has to say. The BBC has decided to close its shortwave high-frequency operation at Daventry in Northamptonshire. The World Service programmes, which are currently transmitted from Daventry, will be transferred to the Wooferton transmitting station in Shropshire, where facilities are being released as a result of a reduction in the Voice of America's requirements. Wooferton has been operated by the BBC for the transmission of Voice of America programmes under an agreement dating back to 1943. Between 30 and 40 jobs will be lost as a result of the Daventry closure, and the corporation will be seeking to resettle the staff involved at other locations as vacancies arise. Bert Gallen, the BBC's chief engineer, transmission and project services, said that the financial arguments for the change are clear-cut, but the closure of Daventry will be viewed with sadness throughout the corporation, as it is very much part of BBC history. It is the oldest of the BBC's transmitting stations, opening in 1925 when the long-wave service started. The first of the BBC's regional transmitter services was opened at Daventry in 1927. Experimental transmissions of still pictures using the Fultograph process were carried out in 1928, and the forerunner to today's World Service was inaugurated from Daventry in 1932. Until 1978, Daventry was also the home of the medium waves transmitter for the BBC's Radio 3 service. The transfer of the Daventry shortwave operation will commence in April 1992, and it is anticipated that it will have been completed by the end of that year. The BBC's association with Daventry will continue beyond that time, as the station will continue to be used as a maintenance base servicing the BBC's domestic radio and television transmitting stations in the area. Well, that's what the BBC's press statement has to say, and we also at Radio Facts gather that what will happen to the transmitters at Daventry is that the six 300 kilowatt transmitters from 1988 vintage are to be moved to Wooferton, while six 250 kilowatt transmitters at Wooferton dating from 1963 to 1964 will be sent abroad to the Ascension Island and Far Eastern relay stations.
Such a bad time. Tried to hurt me, but now I know.